This is from the Atthadanda Sutta, the Buddha speaking. When embraced, the rod of violence breeds danger and fear. Look at people quarreling. I will tell you how I experience dismay. Seeing people floundering like fish in small puddles, competing with one another, as I saw this, fear came into me. The world was entirely insecure. All the directions were in turmoil. Wanting a refuge for myself, I saw nothing that wasn't laid claim to. Seeing nothing in the end but competition, I felt discontent. But then I saw an arrow here, so very hard to see, embedded in the heart. Overcome by this arrow, one runs in all directions. But simply by pulling it out, you don't run. You don't sink. Whatever things are tied down in the world, you shouldn't be set on them. Having totally comprehended sense desire, you should train for your own unbinding. Be truthful, not insolent, not deceptive. Rid of divisiveness. Without anger, the sage should cross over the evil of greed and avarice. They should conquer laziness, weariness, sloth, shouldn't consort with the careless, and shouldn't stand firm in their pride. The person with their heart set on unbinding shouldn't engage in lying, shouldn't create a sense of allure and form, should fully fathom conceit and live refraining from impulsiveness, shouldn't delight in what's old or prefer what's new, grieve over decline or get entangled in what is dazzling and bright. I call greed a great flood, a whirlpool sucking one down, a constant yearning seeking a hold. Preoccupations are ripples. Sense desire, a bog hard to cross over. Not deviating from the truth, the sage stands on high ground. Having renounced all, they are said to be at peace. Having clearly known, they are an attainer of wisdom. Knowing the Dhamma, they are free. Moving rightly through the world, the sage doesn't envy anyone. Whoever has gone over and beyond sense desire and attachment hard to transcend in this world doesn't sorrow, doesn't fret. Free from bonds, their stream is cut. Burn up what's past, have nothing for the future. If you don't grasp at what's in between, you will go about calm. For whom in every way there's no sense of mine, and who doesn't grieve over what is not, they in the world are not defeated, and they suffer no loss. To whom there doesn't occur, this is mine, and for whom nothing is others. Feeling no sense of mineness, they do not grieve at the thought, I have nothing. Not harsh, not greedy, unperturbed, everywhere in tune. This is the reward, I say when asked, for those who are free from preconception. For one unperturbed who understands, there is no accumulating. Abstaining, unaroused, they see security everywhere. The sage does not speak of himself as among those who are higher, equal, or lower. At peace, free from selfishness. They do not cling. They do not reject. You know, there are so many attempts, you know, in the suttas to describe this quality of freedom of the mind, and and what leads to that freedom. And there are so many, you know, that are just so beautiful. And I feel like there is something in this one that I just love, the firmness and the clarity and the strength and the lightness of it. And that relationship between conduct, you know, morality, ethics, and liberation of heart, you know. And this sense of it's a wisdom comes through knowing, right? And to fully understand conceit is how one gets liberated from the sense of me and mine. You know, it's not a rejection of it. It's not an oppression of it, a repression of it. This sense of how careful one can be and how the beauty and that dignity and the humility of that dignity, ultimately, right? That there's no sense of better than or worse than or even equal to. No sense of mine. One doesn't grieve at the thought, I have nothing. Everywhere in tune, going from the beginning, right, where it's like everywhere he looked, he saw turmoil, conflict, competition, unrest, unease, you know, suffering. There's not that many places where the Buddha talks about his kind of pre-enlightenment self, you know, and this motivation to get free. It's really something so moving about that sense of that fear came into him, seeing what he saw, wanting a refuge, you know, that there was nothing that wasn't laid claim to by samsara, by impermanence, you know, by attachment, greed, self. And what is this freedom of mind, you know, that sees security everywhere. Just like the sense of relief in that, of like, wow. And that it's not an arrogant relief and it's not a tense relief. It's like this lightness, you know, that flavor of freedom, hard to attain in this world, to understand the craving, the attachment, you know, the beauty of it, the poignancy of it, the pain of these clingings of the heart, you know, to recognize how hard it is to cross over that. It's so beautiful. So inspiring. And amazing, you know, that there are so many stories in the tradition, you know, of people getting enlightened, right? Understanding the truth and having different degrees of awakening and realizing, you know, different degrees of freedom. And of course we get inspired by these kind of the stories of the greatest release, you know, the greatest achievements of the heart, to be totally unbound from any grasping, any craving, any sense that something needs to be different than the way it is in us right now in this moment. And no rejecting of anything that arises, but clear seeing, not denying, right? Totally seeing the truth of everything, the pain of things, the suffering in the world. And with you know, it's not like bad things didn't happen to these people, you know? People got sick, people died, people had the arahants, fully enlightened beings. It's like they still had to deal with the reality of reality, you know? Gain, loss, pleasure, pain, praise and blame, status and disrepute. Even fully enlightened beings have to deal with those things in their lives, you know. And yet the sense of this unperturbability in that these things happen and there's no loss of connection with care, no loss of connection with this stability. This profound okayness, no matter what happens. There's a famous nun in the time of the Buddha, Upalavana, who also was in, understood to have become fully enlightened and was considered the one of the chief disciples, you know, of the Buddha. And among the nuns was also understood to be foremost in like psychic powers, you know, that she had developed alongside her liberation. And there's a beautiful little story of just her, after her awakening, just practicing alone in the wilderness of the forest. Can imagine even just that, the sense of how strong her mind must have been, that sense of safety, right, in alone in the wilderness, as they described it. And Mara sees her, Mara, the personification of delusion and a troublemaker, you know. Always, you know, they talk about, you know, there's ways that, you know, Mara, he's talked about as kind of a devil and, you know, always trying to kind of pull people down from their right path, you know, and goodness and stuff like that. But it's also understood that, you know, I can't remember all the details. Was he one of the Buddha's cousins in a past lifetime? And it was in a, you know, a woeful realm. And he was so, really, he was alone. You know, he wanted people to be with him and stay with him in samsara. And he felt abandoned when people got enlightened, you know. So he was trying to get people off of their path. And so he sees Upalavana there in the forest all alone and tries to scare her, you know, tries to compel her to come back to the ways of the world, you know, and she could be happier and she shouldn't be out there in the forest all alone. And he had his ways of trying to get people. Meditating, she heard this voice, you know, of Mara. And she recognized it and said to herself, "Oh, this is Mara, the evil one." And replied to him in verse, which I think people, arahants seem to do that. "Though 100,000 rogues just like you might come here, I stir not a hair. I feel no terror. Even alone, Mara, I don't fear you. I can make myself disappear, or I can go inside your belly. I can stand between your eyebrows. You won't catch a glimpse of me. I am the master of my own mind. The bases of power are well developed. I am freed from every kind of bondage. Therefore, I don't fear you, friend." And Mara, the evil one, realizing the bhikkhuni Upalavana knows me, sad and disappointed, disappeared right there. That, like, what it would feel like to be able to say that. "I am the master of my own mind. I'm freed from every kind of bondage. I don't fear you, friend." Right? Like, not even aversion, not even anger, like, still holding Mara in her heart, right, as a friend, right, with this kindness. How beautiful. And it's, you know, it's worthy to look at some of these stories, you know, of from the tradition and in that context of, you know, the people who became fully enlightened, or, you know, the third stage of awakening, you know, real true sainthood, where people have unbound from greed and hatred. But maybe there's still a little bit of delusion left. There's still a little bit of comparing mind, you know, a little bit of a sense of meanness, you know, that isn't totally unbound. Even that's like kind of beyond the scope of our imagination, you know, no craving, no aversion. That sounds pretty good. Worthy. But also to see, you know, that like that these beings weren't doing anything different than we're all trying to do, you know, and they were fortunate to have been around at the time of, you know, the Buddha, perfect teacher, they say. So you got quite the right, you know, medicine for each one, you know, and you see that range of method and encouragement, you know, that's offered in those times, you know, to different people and how beautiful that is. And, you know, they had good karma to be born at that time, but all in all, you know, they struggled with the same things that we struggle with, you know, difficulty in the body, restlessness in the mind, difficulty in their families, difficulty in their jobs, incredible loss, you know, incredible hardship, incredible gain that is then lost, you know, joined with, there's wars, there's famines, there's, you know, there's, the times are so different in one way, you know, coming on 3,000 years ago. And the human heart, the basic human condition, maybe not so different, you know. And so it's like how important it is to recognize that, you know, these folks went through the same stuff, you know, and that we are, people have done what we are doing, gone before us and made it through, you know, made it through a sitting, made it through a retreat, but made it through, you know, the chasm, the flood of fabrication, made it through this overwhelm, this inundation, you know, of greed, hatred, and delusion. Just by doing what we're doing, trying to observe, trying to build enough stability with these beautiful qualities of concentration, of, you know, unity of mind, of patience, of tenderness, of dexterity. You know, you hear that in Upalavana's, her sense of like total mental dexterity, you know, that fluidity, that agility of mind. Not by doing anything different than what we're doing. And, you know, everyone, people had their hardships. You know, there's no shortcuts. It all has to come through this. It all has to go through the digestion, you know, as of the sense doors, you know, of all of this material that's we're meeting moment by moment, of the you know, the elemental realities of the body, the undependable conditions of our lives. It all requires the closer and closer relationship with that, of clarity, of kindness. And trying to observe and see and understand and fathom, you know, these fundamental truths of it all. And go through the ups and downs and the heart dropping in and opening and feeling it all. And then getting to some limit where it recoils and contracts and, you know, is like just as petty and irritable and, you know, difficult as ever, you know. Maybe we don't just go through, like, it's not linear where it's like, oh, you get over that. And then it's just like, you next thing, next thing, next thing. You know, it's the things that we start to be okay with, we stop noticing them in a way. And we start to get into the corners of our hearts, you know, the places that are the hardest material for us to be with, you know. The practice doesn't necessarily get easier. We have more and more capacity to show up for the full spectrum, you know, of the life and death of the human heart, mind, body. And we have our mistakes. We have, you know, we have the places where we feel like we're really on the path, and we have the places where we feel like we diverge and we lose our way. We come back, and that can happen in 5 minutes in a sitting, and it can happen in different ways over periods of time where conditions in our lives may or may not feel like they support, you know, intensive practice, or we get caught up in something that kind of pulls us away from the Dhamma, from our practice for some period of time. And to know it's not irrecoverable is really important too. There's one very famous, beautiful story about a man named Angulimala, who as a child, you know, was, you know, like all, beautiful, beloved, tender, delicate. He had a kind of gentleness of his spirit, so that his mother named him Ahimsa, you know, non-harming, harmless. But in that kind of vulnerability and the conditions of his life, someone, you know, who he respected and trusted led him astray, you know, led him down a path of kind of wrongdoing, you know, saying that this is a way towards happiness, this is a way towards security, and, you know, come join, you know, me and my friends. And, you know, he became a thief and a murderer and a bandit, you know, at some point was feared, you know, across the realm, till he lost his name, Ahimsa, harmless, and began being called Angulimala, right? Which is, mala is a rosary, you know, the prayer beads. But that Anguli means fingers. That he had a rosary made of the bones of the fingers of people he had killed. You know, he was a terror. And he encountered one day, you know, after years of this, you know, years of wrongdoing and wickedness and harm to others, and, you know, the way that we know that withers the heart, you know, and breaks people down into these, you know, very toxic elements in their own minds, hearts, bodies, bitterness, negative affect of the utmost. And he encounters the Buddha one day, and he needs one more victim to have his full mala, you know, and okay, here's this monk, I'll kill this monk. And he goes after the Buddha. And the Buddha also had these powers, you know, he didn't wield them that often, but with Angulimala, he felt it was a worthwhile effort, you know, to find a way to bring him into the Dhamma. And so the Buddha is just walking, doing his walking meditation in the morning. Just like a... And Angulimala charges after him, ready to kill him, you know. And yet somehow, even though the Buddha is walking very slowly, Angulimala can't catch up with him. He's running, he's panting, he's desperate, you know. And the Buddha's just quiet. And finally, exasperated, you know, Angulimala says, "Monk, stop." And the Buddha stops and he turns around and he says, "Angulimala, I have stopped. You need to stop. I have stopped killing living beings, harming others. You need to stop." And for whatever reason, in that moment, you know, it struck him, you know. Surely his parents had told him that. Probably many people had probably told him that, right, at some point. But the Buddha, you know, had his way. And it was time, right? He was ripe for this moment of reckoning. And, you know, kind of did this, it collapsed, like surrendered in this way to, like, the acknowledgement of, yes, he didn't want this. He wanted that. Whatever this peace, this beauty, this serenity, you know, this calm that he witnessed before him, it's like, oh, that is better than what I'm doing. You know, is there any way I can have that? And the Buddha said, yes, you know, come with me, we'll take you in, you know, and ordained him as a monk. And so it said that, you know, he was diligent in his, you know, sila and observing the rules and trying to be a good monastic, you know, a good renunciate, and tried to do this meditation practice, you know, that we're doing. But over and over again, just was so restless. You know, he could not concentrate. He could not, he felt like he could get nowhere in his meditation practice. And the Buddha said, just keep trying, keep trying. And it started to be clear that what was happening for him was just that in this life, right, in this commitment to ethical conduct, in this commitment to trying to be free, he was having to face the truth of what he had done. You know, how much harm he caused. And there is a place in this practice for like healthy remorse. You know, the hiri and otapa, you know, this moral dread, moral shame that's considered like wholesome, right? Of not wanting to harm people for our own sake, right? Not wanting to have the burden of having hurt another being, right? When we really recognize how awful it is to be harmed, there is this healthy dread, right, of not wanting to do that. And the healthy remorse for seeing where we have caused harm. And the healthy part of that is intended to inspire us to do good, you know, to be better. But of course, we know that it can lead towards so much just unhealthy remorse and rumination and guilt. And that's what was happening for Angulimala. Just, you know, it was too much. It's just like there was too much material of telling him how bad a person he was, how unworthy, right, he was of this awakening, of this unbinding. And so he wrestled and wrestled, right, with what felt like this unfruitful practice for so long. And one day he was going on the morning alms rounds, you know, as monks and nuns still do, you know, in the tradition where they only eat what is offered, you know, to them. And so, you know, he went on his bindabat and just his robes and begging bowl and just, you know, you wander through the village and stop in certain places. And if people are inspired, they'll give you food, you know, and that's what you'll eat for the day. And he was walking through the village and he noticed a commotion at a house in the village. And some people came out to see him and they said, please help us. You know, there's a woman in this house who's in the middle of giving birth. And she is in trouble, and the child is in trouble. It's not going well. We need help. Do something, please. You know, help us. And there was this powerful experience, right? You can just imagine his feeling like so ground down, you know, from his own actions, from his own practice of kind of really at this sort of low point, and yet maybe broken to some degree in a way that opened his heart to something he had not felt in ages, right? This compassion. Going in, seeing this woman suffering, right? Knowing that there was a child that might die. Seeing the family grieving and worrying and fretting and not being able to do anything about it. He was overwhelmed, right? In the face of suffering. And so this great compassion arose in him of like, I want to help. I need to be able to do something to help this. But he didn't know what he could do. And so he went to the Buddha and he said, what can I do? Tell me, like, I have to be able to help like this. You know, I've caused so much harm. And so the Buddha says, okay, go back and say, my name is Angulimala, and as far as I can remember, I've never harmed another being. And by the goodness of that, may you be safe. May your child be safe. And he kind of like, okay, I guess the Buddha said I should do it. I'm following orders. And he kind of went partway back and he's like, I can't do this. I've made this commitment to truthfulness, right? To not lying. And I know I've harmed so much. So he went back to the Buddha and he said, I can't say that, you know. Tell me something else I can do. And he said, okay, go back and say, since coming to the noble life, I have not knowingly harmed another living being. And by the goodness of that, may you be safe. May your child be safe. And Angulimala said, oh, I can say that. Right? That since becoming a monk, since ordaining, since, you know, that he had tried his best and he knows that he had not intentionally harmed another being, not intentionally taken another life. And so he went back into the village and he went back to this house and he offered this blessing. Since coming to the holy life, I do not recall having intentionally harmed, killed another being. By the goodness of that, by the goodness of that sila, of that ethical conduct, may you be safe. May your child be safe. And it said that at that moment, the woman gave birth to the child and both were healthy. And everyone rejoiced, you know. Rejoiced in the blessing, rejoiced in Angulimala's role in this, right? And his ability to find a connection to his own goodness amidst all that he knew that he had done. And like the miracle of that. Right, like a genuine miracle that occurred because of the truthfulness of that goodness. And to this day, in Southeast Asia and Theravadan Buddhist countries, people will chant the Angulimala Paritta Sutta, that phrase in Pali, at childbirth. You know, for the blessing of the childbirth, of the mother and the child. And just to think of that, right, of like, that this person who, you know, did more wickedness than any of us can imagine, right, who made this transformation, and that is still so revered in the most delicate, tender, vulnerable of all like human experiences, right, of childbirth, that the beauty of this transformation and of the truth of that goodness is reminded of that in this most vulnerable time, you know, that it's honored in that way. How beautiful. And so it said that, you know, from at that point Angulimala went back and started to practice again, right? And not in denial of the actions that he had done, but that he had found some connection, right, to his own goodness, right? Through the sila, he had this experience of compassion, of feeling, and of that compassion having an effect in the world, and the goodness of that, and the beauty of that, and feeling like, what does it feel like to be responsible for good, for healing, for health, for well-being? And that he could be a vehicle for that as well. And that his practice transformed. He was able to find quietude. He was able to find the sense of samadhi, right? Of unification, of coming together, of dropping in, and of mindfulness. And it said, you know, in no time at all, as they say, you know, he became an arahant, you know, a fully enlightened being. And even so, you know, he would walk through the village for alms and people would throw rocks at him, throw stones at him, curse him, you know. And he went back to the Buddha and he was like, hey, what's going on? I did this good thing. I'm I'm an arahant. And he said, yes, it's wonderful, amazing. How many people have come from where you came from to where you've ended? You know, not many. But you did those things. You harmed all those people. The karma of that doesn't just get erased. You still have to live out the anger, the resentment, you know, the agony that you've created in the world. And the world is still going to dish that back out at you, you know. So, great. You understood? And the sense of accepting that, right? It's not resentful, not confused, understanding, of course, right? Of course, liberating the heart and mind doesn't free us from the results of our actions. But how beautiful, you know, how much hope this gives any of us, you know, for this path. Because not only, you know, is it almost inconceivable to create as much harm as Angulimala did, that to know that even from there, we can be redeemed, right, through wisdom, through kindness, in this way. Through the liberation of the heart and mind. It doesn't preclude, you know, our own actions, you know, that sometimes can haunt us, you know, or just the past, our role in drama, our role in difficult things. Maybe sometimes we do remember, you know, unskillful actions that we've committed, and we question our own worthiness, you know, of this liberation, of this freedom. To find some way to connect with our own goodness, to remember the beautiful qualities of mind that are present and available whenever we can find our way to them, how important that is. There's another story, not from this tradition, but I heard recently that I will share. It's really very powerful. It's about the deity Quetzalcoatl, from, you know, maybe by different names, but in the Aztec, Mayan, kind of Mesoamerican world, honored, you know, and revered as this feathered serpent, you know, primordial source of culture and beauty and goodness, you know, in the world, and creation, ceremony. There's also an aspect of him that was a human, that was a priest, ruler, you know, of this city in the Toltec time. And it was very peculiar, even in his own time. He was a very quiet being, you know, a real renunciate, a real recluse. Had a palace, you know, in the heart of the city. That was really a place for quietude, for meditation, and for fasting, for sacrifice, for prayer. And he was considered the source of so much beauty that was offered to his people, right? That he had learned how to, you know, the ways of plants and medicine and healing, you know, and shared that with people. And he had learned the crafts and, you know, how to weave out of materials and how to build and how to design and the rituals for ceremony and celebration and culture, music, you know, where to find the materials, how to pray in the right way for these things and over them so that they were used for good, you know, and to keep people and keep the society, the community in alignment, you know, with ethics, with beautiful conduct, you know, the forces of the natural world and the spirits. And so he was a leader, but a recluse at the same time, you know, very different world, you know. Sometimes it seems like it might be nice to have something more like that, you know. And he lived a very, it's like we look at this, like a very disciplined life in the morning prayers, you know, the ritual fires, the, he said for sacrifices, it was like when he would walk, he would just, if he found a dead butterfly or a dead snake, you know, he would gather those, he would offer those on the altar for burning, you know, burn incense, kopal. Maybe with the magay thorn, you know, he would make small blood offerings, you know, of himself. And would fast, right? It was a, it was like every, this daily fasting, right? Sometimes for longer periods, sometimes for less. This incredible spiritual discipline and seclusion, you know, that he had committed to in his life. But it was at a time where other gods were gaining power in their places. And some of them wanted more than butterflies and snakes. There was a building desire on the part of other deities for human sacrifice, right? Human hearts. And so there was like pressure on this community and others to do more of that, right? To have human sacrifice, that the gods wanted the heart, right? In honor of, you know, what everything they did. And Quetzalcoatl is like, no, it's not necessary. We do not need to do that, right? Fasting, prayer, small sacrifices, it's enough. And so one of these other gods, Tezcatlipoca, which name means smoking mirror, was like, we have to get rid of this guy, right? He's in our way of more hearts. So let's just see, let's find a way. And so one day him and his friends, they knock on, you know, Quetzalcoatl's palace and they say, oh, can we visit? You know, we haven't seen you in so long. You're always hiding. You know, let's, you know, come, you know, cousin, let's hang out. No, I'm fasting. I'm in seclusion right now. Sorry. Oh, but I bring a gift. You're going to love it. I'm going to show you yourself in a way you've never seen it. Come on. Okay. He lets them in. And Tezcatlipoca has a giant obsidian mirror, which he's associated with, his name, Smoking Mirror. So you can polish these pieces of obsidian so that they're so shiny that they produce a reflection. And so he brought this gift to Quetzalcoatl and he said, oh, here, look at yourself. See yourself. And Quetzalcoatl looked at it and he was ashamed, right? He felt he was ugly. And this mirror, of course, it's not just any mirror. It's Tezcatlipoca's mirror. So it's not just like he felt ugly physically. He felt ugly inside, right? It was this reflection back to him of a version of himself that he didn't want to see, you know. He hadn't had training to see it. He had all this discipline, but not necessarily this ability to have this kind of reflective experience in a way that felt stable. And so he was shocked and he said, I'm going into hiding. I'm ugly. I'm horrible. I'm like a horrible person. Leave me alone. And they said, no, you're not. You're good. We're going to help you. We'll come back. And so, you know, he was just in this turmoil of self-doubt, right? And self-judgment and feeling worthless, feeling hopeless. And these people, these other beings came back and said, oh, we've brought you a gift, another gift. This beautiful adornment, you know, a jade and gold mask for you to wear, a beautiful feathered cape. You know, you put that on, you will be beautiful. And he puts it on, and it's like, oh, it covers himself, right? And it does look beautiful. And he's compelled by, yes, oh, wow, this is the version of myself that I like. This is who I would like to be. This is who I want people to see me as. Oh, yeah, you look great. Man, people need to see this. You should come out. You know, no, I'm okay. Well, we'll bring a few people over. You know, we'll have a little, bring some food, a little party. It'll be good. You know, you'll feel better about yourself. They get in the door. The door's open now. You know, they bring the food and they bring the party and they bring the pulque, right? The fermented beverage. And they're dining and they're feasting, and it's like, oh, get alcohol, have some pulque. It's good for you. It's sacred. I'm fasting. You know, I don't do that. Oh, come on. I'll have one. Oh, it's pretty good. I'll have two. I'll have three. I'll have four. Oh, let's call Quetzalpetlatl, his sister, also a renunciate, sacred woman, medicine woman, healer, leader, fasting, you know, in her own palace down the way. Call her over. Mostly in these ways, there's the duality, you know, of both aspects, you know, of being. She comes. More people come, the party ensues, a big festival happens, and boom, boom, little by little, it's like all of the precepts are let go of, broken, right? The morning comes and no one rings the morning bell. No one burns the morning rituals. No one tends the fires. All of the sacred way falls apart. And at some point, Quetzalcoatl wakes up from his stupor, you know, hungover, recognizes, you know, it's midday. Everything has fallen apart. He recognizes the harm he caused, you know, the falling from his discipline. And there's like a different kind of shame, right? Not the arrogance and the egoistic and the vanity shame that maybe he felt the night before, but this sense of, oh, I have let myself down, right? Of unwholesome action, of responsibility for that. And he gets up and he recognizes right away, I have more work to do. And I cannot lead this place anymore. I can't hold this position of authority. This degree of failure of my responsibilities, you know, can't be just covered over right now. I have to understand what happened here, you know, what caused me to do this. And so he called people to build him a box, a stone box. And he went in and he had them cover it, and he spent 4 days in there. Fasting, similar maybe to what here in Lair, you know, Lakota people would say, Amblecha, crying for a vision, right? Many different traditions across the Americas, these periods of fasting and praying, you know. And after his 4 days, it's like he realized he needed to go on a journey. He needed to leave his post and begin a journey eastward to find his way, you know, and to understand what had happened for himself. And so the details of that journey are not clear, but clearly they're not recorded, or they were recorded, but what exists of this story is like these bare fibers, right, that the Spanish didn't burn in all of these codices, right? That there are enough little stories left. So it could be, of course, that the story of that journey is known and was known, right? But not recorded in writing at this point. But that eventually he comes to the coast, you know, and at that point has a different transformation, right? Understanding of himself. And real and wants to make his whole life an offering, right? To goodness, to the gods, right? To this path that he has found. Beyond just discipline, right? And the rigidity of that, even as beautiful as it was, that it didn't give him the sort of power of wisdom, the robustness of actually being able to face these reflections, you know. But that by the time he gets to the coast, it's different. And it said that he filled the canoe up with all of his belongings and all of his regalia and all of his sacred objects and cast himself out into the ocean. And according to those days and in that way, what lit offered himself in a sacred fire, you know, in this canoe. And it said that from that fire, all of the smoke turned in as it rose into all of the birds of the jungles and the mountains that lifted up into the air. And that everything else that burned, except for his heart, that just kept burning and burning and burning and went up into the sky and is there today as the morning star of Venus. As a inspiration, right? As a recognition, as a remembrance of this beautiful sacrifice, right? And as a metaphor, right, for our practice, this idea of what we sort of talking about, you know, of like the surrendering to the truth, this willingness to go through the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion, and all of the turmoil and tumult and ups and downs and being sick of it and wanting and getting high and then crashing. And it's like the fire of this purification. How hard it is, how painful it is, and what a beautiful offering it is. And again, it's not in, there's no text left, there's no story that I know, you know, and maybe there are traditions, maybe there are stories told in community, you know, of Quetzalpetlatl, right, the sister. I think about her, I wonder, you know, did she also wonder about this obsidian mirror and its power? Right, and maybe go and find a way less metaphorical, but more like our way, you know, of seeing that it's like, well, we need to have a relationship with this power of reflection. Yes, the discipline of our renunciation, of our carefulness with our conduct, of not harming, of, you know, not intoxicating ourselves into heedlessness, you know, all of these things, it's important. It's foundational. But that there's actually something deeper around wisdom, right, that can be destabilizing and worth exploring, worth knowing more deeply, right? This idea of what would it be like to find this, you know, our own obsidian mirror of mindfulness, of vipassana practice, of this willingness to have everything reflected immediately back to us in our hearts, our minds, our bodies, our, you know, and to see the beauty of that and to see the things we might be ashamed of, but to not always be recoiling from the shame, right? Not always feel like we have to be so afraid of seeing the hard things about ourselves as well. And that actually by the process of going through that, of being willing to see it and willing to bear our longings, you know, who we want to be and our aspirations and our failures, that we're not irredeemable because of that. In fact, it's through the honest reflection and relationship with that and the working with that that we come to this beautiful liberation, you know, and this sainthood that we aspire to. this freedom, and this beauty of heart, mind. And that these beings who found their way to this, you know, that they'd had to go through what we had to go through. And that it might feel like we're alone in our lives in this practice, we're alone in our cushion on this, but to recognize, oh, we're in a room full of people who are going through some version of the same stuff, you know. How many people have sat in this room over the years, struggling, you know, and achieving, finding their way just like we are. How many rooms around the world are like this? You know, how many people have gone before and are still going through it, right? What was this community of seekers, of strivers, you know, of people longing to stop harming, stop harming ourselves, stop harming others? And the mythological, the heroism that it takes is level of myth, is myth, right? That's how you know how big and hard this is like, we have to be inspired by these stories that are, you know, at this level of human existence, right? Between history and myth, archetypal, deep, profound aspirations that we are part of a family of. And that there are people who have found their way. You can take inspiration from that, relief in that, guidance from that. And also know it's always up to us. In the end, we have to do it ourselves. The beauty and the promise of this practice. So let's just sit for a moment. I am the master of my own mind. The bases of power are well developed. I am freed from every kind of bondage. Therefore, I don't fear you, friend.